Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. So we recited the four directions for the Brahma Viharas, and that form of that is very beautiful. It might remind you, there's four tetrads in there, so there's four, each of the four Brahma Viharas: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, and each one are radiated in the four directions. So that might remind you of a form that the Buddha uses. The Anapanasati Sutta, the mindfulness of breathing, is also four tetrads. It's a nice organizational structure for the mind, isn't it? It just seems so easy to remember four of this, four of that, and there's four of them. And it's just very formulaic. It's also very impersonal. So all you're doing is radiating to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, beings. And so one of our problems, perhaps, or confusion, when we try to radiate loving kindness, is that we have taken it personally. The whole culture talks about who you love and about yourself. So it personalizes everything. Everything's personal. But when we get into the spiritual domain, especially the Buddhist spiritual domain, nothing's personal. So this is actually a great relief. You don't have to reflect on the individual characteristics of anything, including yourself. You're just one of those beings. And a lot of people have trouble with radiating it for themselves. But if you imagine yourself, you're just one of the beings to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, well, you're in then. And in order to depersonalize yourself, so you're radiating loving kindness to yourself, and people have this, I talked quite a bit about it last night, why you can't do that or why you have problems with it is because you see your own mind, you personalize everything. But that you have to depersonalize. The Buddha himself did not take himself personally. And he quite paradoxically said to people who were standing right in front of him that they could not see the Buddha. You cannot see the Buddha, even not only after somebody asked him, what, you know, will, can I stay in touch after you die? He said, you can't get in touch even now while I'm standing in front of you. You cannot meet the Buddha. But the whole teaching is this, is there is no Buddha. There is no you. There is no anybody. And the only way you can contact that truth, is when you see somebody, you see Dhamma. When you see so he said, whoever sees Dhamma sees the Buddha. Whoever sees the Buddha sees only Dhamma. You don't see the Buddha. When you see the Buddha, you don't see the Buddha. You're only seeing Dhamma. Dhamma is the truth that there's nothing solid, lasting, enduring, essential. There are only processes flowing. Endlessly flowing. When you see clouds, you do not see castles. Even though they look like castles. When you put your hand through them, nothing to them. No substance. Everything, reality is just cloud-like. The Buddha gives a whole bunch of series of similes about the nature of reality and like a bubble. and you or foam on the water. Of course, they were living in nature, so when you're near rapids and so forth, you see sometimes foam appears on the surface of water. And the nature of foam is it looks solid, but when you grab it, nothing. All you get is a wet hand. So this is the true nature of reality. Not scientific, although it is scientific as well, but the Buddha is not interested in scientific exercises, which are only functions of the intellect. Buddhism the Buddha would have been a very obscure and forgotten North Indian philosopher. I would ask anybody in the room to name off four science philosophers from the Greeks, 5th century BC. There were plenty of them. They had atomic theories and all kinds of stuff. I can name one, Democritus. That's why you have an atomic theory. He's the formulator of atomic theory. And like, anybody know Democritus? Been a big influence on you? No. It may be intellectually and scientifically true that everything's just atomic, but and now what? So because the issue is not, that's not how we are, that's not what a human is, that's not how they think, that's not how they feel, that's not how they conduct themselves, it doesn't have enough to make you live. And so our the Dhamma is something that allows you to do that. So it's an approach to reality that is human, and it's about where you really live. So this, the way we see things can be whatever's useful. And the experience of loving kindness, this sublime swelling of emotion, or the other ones, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, are just so gorgeous that what we really want to do is get there. We don't want to worry too much whether we're following a bunch of rules or how realistic we are. Because it's not the point. The point is not whether anybody's lovable or not. It's to get there. And so, and when we get there, it's a very different view of things. It's impersonal, insubstantial. And that's kind of why we make this Buddha image there. There's nothing personal about it, right? There's no shape, no face to it. It's more or less absent, the absence of the Buddha. This is close to when the Buddha says, when you cannot see the Buddha. But if you see Dhamma, then you see the Buddha. So if you're looking for the Buddha in there, there's just an outline suggesting things. And mostly what it's suggesting is there's nothing there. It's absent. This is the issue when you have different cultures, like our Buddha image up there is this one, the marble one, came from Vietnam, actually. A Vietnamese lady donated it, and she had it specially carved there. It's marble from the special mountain, a white marble mountain. But she had a Western nose put on it. So it looks like you guys. Big noses. From the Asian perspective. But that's a lot of trouble to go with, isn't it? Personalizing. Every culture has to transform their Buddha images into something that looks like them, and on and on. Of course, the early after the Buddha died, there were no Buddha statues. And of course, during the suttas, you will never see a monk walks into a sala, bows to a Buddha statue. In the entire suttas, there are no Buddha statues. There's no nothing. Unless you meet the Buddha himself, you can't bow to the Buddha. So it's a long time afterwards we develop these other forms, and in some way these forms pin us down. They start to I mean, there were good attempts by artists to allow your imagination to develop. By the way, so some of these Buddha images are very exaggerated. You know, the huge long ears and sometimes very long arms and of a gigantic proportions. You know, they're 50 feet tall. Or Kusala is working on some. We're going to do some footprints here, footprints of the Buddha. So we're talking about them, and I told her, by the way, they can be 12 feet long, you know. They left big footprints. Footprints are much closer to the time, so much closer to the essence of what the Buddha is saying, or an empty seat, and that's another what was left. During the lifetime of the Buddha, they put out a seat in case he visited, because he'd sometimes drop in at an unexpected time, just wandering around. So they started to put a seat out in case he dropped in. And he couldn't cover all the monasteries. As the monasteries grew, he couldn't cover all the monasteries by any means. So mostly that seat might have been unoccupied for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. After he died, they kept the seat. So that was the first legacy, the remembrance. And it's so close to the way the Buddha talked. It's just an empty seat. And then some places he went, you know, he left a footprint in the mud or whatever, and they made a cast of it, and they kept the footprints around, just some aspect of him. And, of course, a few remnants from the funeral where there's just a few hairs or a few little debris from the body. That's all. And those are more depersonalized in some ways. It just allows you to project, you know, that experience of having read a book that you really loved, and then the movie comes out and you go see the movie and it's never as good as the book, you know. So why is that? Because you the characters are not who you saw in the book. And if you try to explain that to a kid, the characters you saw, wait a sec, there are no pictures in that book. How did you see anybody from all those little black squiggles? Well, that's the way the mind works, isn't it? And it's closer to reality. Sometimes it's more real than real. And maybe the movie is boring because it's too real, you know. So there's a huge level of the mind that functions differently than the literal. It's not literal. It's abstract. It's about feeling. It's how it feels. So this is you're really invited in these things not to follow a kind of strict technique or method for this, but to feel the spaciousness of the opportunity to just find your way to this emotion. That's all that matters. It doesn't matter how you get there. But he's giving you hints about how to get there by just saying towards the north. Open your heart to the north. Open your heart to the south. Open your heart to the east. Open your heart to the west. Purely, what's in the north? Beings. Not any particular beings, just beings. So it might be so important to kind of get away from the individuality and the personal, to get this feeling. It's a vast and open and doesn't require concrete sort of beings. One of the images I use is imagining you're in a kind of a theater with a curtain. Well, when you go to a theater, usually they have this. The curtain is closed, and then there's something going to be revealed behind that curtain. So imagine that you hear all kinds of voices and sounds back there behind the curtain. You know there's humans. Maybe there's some sounds of cats or dogs or whatever. Something back there. You know beings are back there, but you can't see them. And so you don't know who's back there. And so that's close to this radiation of loving kindness. There, all you know is there's beings back there. And then you know how beings are. The Buddha explains to you a few things that are in common with all beings. One is that they suffer. If you're conscious at all, you will have problems. And if you're not conscious at all, you're not a being. You're a rock or a stone, a log of wood. At the Buddhist funeral rite says, this body lies on the ground like a log of wood. Consciousness has departed. Not conscious. No problem. That body has no problems. No consciousness. Consciousness. As long as you're conscious. And untrained consciousness is susceptible to friction, to tension, to stress, to pain. And because it's untrained, it's just a matter of time till it falls into it again. And everybody knows what that's like. And so we also attribute it to other beings, so we know what it's like to suffer. And so this also arouses some sympathy and empathy for other beings. And this empathy allows us to open the heart as well, to see the situation we're in. And also just a reflection on death allows us to look beyond the game, because when you stay within the life, then there's kind of a game that goes on. There is winning and losing, but the game ends, and then there's no winning and losing. And when you stop with the winning and losing, then there's more space around that. So when you're reflecting, loving kindness and death go together nicely. Our enemies will die. Our loved ones will die, and strangers will die. We'll all die. And from that kind of that perspective, kind of gentles you out, and reminds you that it's just a game, and the game ends. And if you're peaceful enough while you're reflecting on that, then you lose the seriousness of the game. The game loses its seriousness. And maybe you decide that it's much better to play in the game. And the rules for it from the perspective of death, everything changes. When you don't take the rules seriously, then it's just a playful game. You know? So remember the Franciscan monks being playful with the game. So when the bandits came and stole all their food a couple of times, they didn't round up the posse and go and hang them, as was the fashion of the day. They went up and fed them. Now that's playful. that's cute, you know. That is the way to play the game. And that's so when the loving kindness is cultivated, you can do things like that. I remember hearing this story about some Christian minister in the States. He was 6'8", a very imposing gentleman, and very, very determined to spread the gospel, etc. But he was a real Christian. And somebody said that until you got on his bad side, you never knew what it was like to be loved. And I thought, that's cool. You can imagine getting on the bad side of somebody 6'8" and expecting the normal response to it, and him having understood that isn't the instructions. love thine enemy. So you never knew what it was to be loved until you got on his wrong side. And that's a nice little thing to remember. Anybody get on your wrong side? See what it's, if you can pull it off. See if you can say, this is a really good opportunity for loving kindness. When they get on my wrong side. So, that's, you're playing a different game now. It's that, come on, don't get serious. Just because you get on somebody's wrong side, or somebody gets on your wrong side, you get all serious on me. Loving kindness is never serious. It never gets grim. It never plays that game. Never. So it has lightness to it. It is, that's why in some ways humor is a kind of a hint of loving kindness. And maybe, of course, when you're with your friends and you love your friends, you laugh. Because there's no threat and there's no tension and there's a certain amount of loving kindness there and laughter is close to that. So you have to, I mean, all of these things are clues and strategies and games that you play. They're creative and they're artistic games that you play. Look, the whole Buddhist world is one of the most prolific inventors of beautiful buildings and beautiful paintings and beautiful sculpture and all kinds of things like this. They're all, it's just a continuous work of art dedicated to making you less serious so that you don't worry about dying and stuff like that. You don't take it seriously. And you don't take yourself seriously because that's, to be serious is to have a self. If you have no self, how can you be serious? The Buddha is never serious. He's not laughing like a fool all the time. In fact, it's one of the rules for monks, don't go laughing in the village. Don't go laughing loudly in the village. And also, you're not supposed to tickle each other in the water. You're not supposed to tickle each other, and you're not supposed to splash laughingly in the water. Yeah. Which is, I mean, why would monks be splashing laughingly in the water? Well, because... you can start to get pretty lighthearted in the robes. I lived in a monastery on a lake one time in Thailand, and we had to take a canoe and boats across to on our arms around every day. So we were always around the lake, and we went swimming in the lake as well. The Thais were not, many of them don't know how to swim. I was in a boatload of them, and the boat was, I don't know whether you've seen those canal boats, but they have a huge, like, Chevy GM engine or something mounted way up high and a great huge long propeller and a 12-year-old is running it. There's no, all of the belts are whirling at furious, don't put your hands in there because there's no protection to it. It's thundering and taking you across the lake in this very dubious canal boat, which is not supposed to be on open water. And you, me, the only one that can swim, and 15 Thai monks. I'm thinking, if we go over. But we did swim, and it is, you know, it's lighthearted. It's nice to bathe in the lake and to swim in the lake. It's lighthearted. But we try to keep to the Vinaya rules, not to sport with laughter in the lake. You're allowed to smile, though. It's nice. It's what a strange and beautiful thing. These guys living off in the woods, apparently doing nothing all day long, except getting very into a very high hazard boat every day, and staying light. And that's a very important thing for the world, is that somebody has to do that. Somebody needs to not take it seriously. And so, I mean, that's the invitation to you as well, is to just start to play more. And, you know, you really have to remind, you know, you have to associate with, when you associate with grim people, they, you know, you start to think it's serious. You know, they can convince you it's utterly serious. Melodramatic people, too. Everything seems to be a drama. Seems. But then there are people who are light and not, it's not a melodrama. There's really, it's just faintly funny, that's all. And so you have to associate with that and to find some help. So that's the first blessing in life, is not to associate with the serious. No, actually, it's this, not to associate with the foolish, which is almost identical to the serious. To associate with the lighthearted or the wise. So, of course, lightness, both buoyancy of body and lightness of mind, these are part of every expression of ordinary, like, English, because that's the way it feels. The heart is light. The mind is full of light. I mean, we even have the same word, like light and light. Are synonyms. What's that when it's the same word and it's the homonyms? Yeah. So this is something that you have to establish even before any kind of meditation. Meditation is not serious. And when you sit down to jhana yourself, you sit down at ready to receive a laser through your forehead, you know, it's like, I shall be one-pointed. No, it's not. It just isn't that way. You're just focusing the binoculars. You're looking out at the stars, and you're focusing the binoculars, looking at the moon. Open mouth, just staring at the moon through the binoculars. The binoculars are just amplifications, right? And meditation is simply the attempt to focus your mind, but not like a laser that will burn through a sheet of metal, like a pair of binoculars, to focus like that. So you don't have to strain your eyes anymore. Your mind is lucid and clear, and so it's not fuzzy and strained and tense. So that's the idea. The emotional center is energized because it's not burdened. So you've taken off the heavy jackets, the clumping winter boots and all of that stuff, because you're at the dance. You know, it's a sock hop. You fit so much. The clunky boots are off and everything, and it just feels good to skate around a little bit on your socks, you know. So this is, it's light, and this is the description of the body. The body is light. These are the two primary jhana factors. The first thing that distinguishes you, the beginning of supernormal experience, is you're happy and you are experiencing pleasure. This is supernormal. The only reason why it's different than when you're at a movie or something like that, which is also, you can be happy and at ease at a movie, but that's based on outer things. And the Buddha is just saying, darn, you know, that it's so hard to keep up that kind of happiness, lightness stuff out there by sights and sounds and various things. It's just hard to keep it up. So it's really nice that the mind can do it from an inner source. And you can if you can find that, you really, the dangers which are inseparable from sensory experience, you know, the danger of sensory experience is that it's treacherous and you can lose it. And it's and you then you fall into a sense of despair and depression because you can't you what little food you get from the world can be taken away from you by all kinds of ways. It's dangerous, treacherous, hard to maintain happiness in the world through the senses. And so if you could find a way out of that, find some inner resource. The Buddha talks, gives a simile about, he's talking to a fellow, he says, now, there are two kinds of fires. What if we, and there, one of them is made with wood, you burn wood with and make a fire. And then there's a, what if I could show you how to make a fire without any wood? Which would be the better fire? And so the man says, the one without the wood, that's a neat trick. And he says, so there's two kinds of fires. This is the one with the wood is the fires of the sensory experience of the outside world. One without the wood is the fire of the mind well composed, as in samadhi. And this is a fire, they're both fires, but one is has a different fuel and is a superior. You don't need the coarse fuel of wood. It's just radiantly warm and sustained. So this is, we're not trying to deprive you of happiness. The path, and this is quite often misunderstood even by Buddhists, this is the path. The Buddha renounces the path of pain. He did give it a good shot, and most of the people practicing in India at the time were convinced that the way to escape the dangers of dependency on the sensory world was to burn it out by pain. You would get there to a kind of a higher detached state through pain. And the Buddha gave it a good shot, and he realized, you know, this just doesn't lead to any exalted pleasure. This just leads to more pain. This pain leads to pain, leads to pain. So he gave it up, and he remembered at that time being a child in ease under the rose apple tree and experiencing a kind of joy which didn't come from the outside world. And he at that moment, so the story goes, at that moment, he realizes this is the path. But notice, what is the path? He just experienced the first jhana as a child. He remembers that, and he concludes, this is the path. It's the path of happiness. This is blameless. This will never lead to something negative. This happiness is not to be feared. This is a good happiness, a pleasure not to be feared, a superior pleasure not to be feared. I will follow this. And that, so he follows that to enlightenment. He follows it through the eighth factor of the path, samadhi, is the approximate cause for his enlightenment. It's all pleasure from that time on. He finds the jhanas, it's pleasurable. Not to be feared. No concern about attachment to it or anything like that. Do not, that is not something you want to worry about. It's a pleasure. You cannot have it and not have a pleasure. It is pleasurable. So this is why it's a unique path that nobody had discovered before. It's the path of pleasure. But not worldly pleasure. It's the path of a superior. He's discovered a superior form of energy. He's like nuclear. He's like solar. Yeah, like us, solar. So this is a source of boundless energy and pleasurable. And the Buddha says, please stop with the pain. I know that it's going to be tricky if you can't if you recognize that there's a problem with depending on worldly sensory experiences for happiness, the problem is, if you give it up, what's the alternative? So he says, yeah, there is that. But if you can find this another source, then it will, not only will you give up the worldly stuff, but it will fall away by itself, because this one is superior. There's a few things to tinker with. That is that even if you're, he has a conversation with a man who is a layperson, is married, has kids, and lives the household life, but he's attained the second stage of enlightenment. It's called Sakadagami. That's not his name. Sakadagami is the one who has attained the second stage of enlightenment. But this guy comes to the Buddha, and he says, of course, I've attained the Sakadagami, and I've seen the Dhamma, but still, from time to time, I experience lust and anger. And what can I do about that? And the Buddha says, well, one thing is you're living the household life, so it's harder. So this guy's second stage of enlightenment, and still, from time to time, he has lapses, he forgets, and he gets involved in sensory pleasures, and a little bit of anger comes up, and so forth. And the Buddha says, well, because you do not have access to alternative forms of pleasure, you drift back into it. So he's got realization. He has vipassana. He has seen something enough to allow him at the second stage of enlightenment, but he still is experiencing the hindrances from time to time. What's the way out of that? The Buddha says the way out of that is you have to cultivate, if you can in your life, you have to cultivate an alternative form of pleasure, and that is samadhi. And then you will not fall into that. And you will accelerate your progress, and you will come to the third stage of enlightenment. In the third stage of enlightenment, one does not experience anymore lust or anger. It's over. Now, one is only left with a few attachments, and one of them is samadhi. But that's not an attachment to be feared. It's not an attachment to be feared. It's self-eliminating. Its tendency is to go farther and farther and farther in the direction of the path and towards nibbana. That's its nature. It leads onwards. So that's why it's not to be feared. So this cultivation of the pleasure of loving kindness, the pleasures of compassion and so forth, these are valid and core expressions of the Eightfold Path. And if you can ignite them, then you get this other fire. And then the requirement of the external pleasures tends to fall away by itself. Right. You have this kind of inner generator of what you need, and humans need happiness. You can only endure so long without happiness, without pleasure, without joy. So this is a kind of a facsimile of enlightenment of nibbana. Nibbana is composed of this as well. The jhanas are temporary enlightenment, a temporary facsimile of enlightenment. The Buddha himself says this. So it's endlessly encouraged. The suttas are full of endless encouragement by the Buddha to develop loving kindness, and that it's, you cannot do it and not enjoy it. It's in its joy itself. And he says, quit getting all personal on me. Don't, never mind who you are, who they are, whatever. It's about the joy. It's about the pleasure of it, because that leads in the right direction. So it's just that these are just helpful hints to how to cultivate this loving kindness. It's not personal, but it's very pleasurable. And it's not serious. It's playful. Okay, so I'll leave that for tonight.